Sorry to Bother You, I saw it in theaters, and that's a weird movie. Yeah. And I know if you can't buy into the weirdness early on, you will not get into it as it goes on.
It will only get weirder.
Hi, and welcome to Episode of Cine Nation. My name is Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Thomas Horton.
This episode's very weird because we're in the midst of a crazy time in the world. We usually like delving into subgenres and directors and all that good stuff. We were prepping for a director episode, and I feel like with everything that was happening, all of our prep went out the window. And so I watched like none of the movies I should have been watching. But I'm really excited when we do that episode. But I just guess I really just wanted to, like, with all this craziness, just to kind of like break our usual format and kind of just, it's more lax, I guess you could say. And we're going to take a lot of questions or some questions from our listeners. And then we have like a second part of the show. We'll kind of delve into some stuff you guys should be watching during or give some recommendations of what you should be watching during this kind of time where a lot of people are at home and needing stuff to do. And hopefully you're social distancing. And Thomas, how are you holding up?
Yeah, I'm good, man. I'm good. We're hanging in there. Catching up on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Catching up on a lot of content, so there's a silver lining, all that stuff I, like, said, I never had time to finish. There's a lot of shows I had, like, one season left, and I never, like, finished that last season. That's what, like, I've kind of been knocking out recently. But even just, like, I'm working from home still, like, full-time. But, you know, if you're not sharing an office with somebody, you can still, like, put something on in the background that that I wasn't really doing before. So blowing through content, for sure.
What all have you been watching?
I watched Mythic Quest on Apple TV Plus,
okay,
which was actually a lot of fun. It's a comedy from the guys who did Always Sunny, about a video game company, and actually a lot better than I was expecting it to be. The Always Sunny is occasionally will have like a really poignant episode when you go like, wow, that was great, and having like a lot of the writers from that come over and then be also teamed up with David Gordon Green, who directed like the first six episodes, makes it like it's a fun workplace comedy. But every once in a while, you'll have moments where you're like, "Wow, that was more than I expected out of the only comedy on Apple TV Plus right now."
Yeah, all our stuff's dramas, pretty much. And I haven't watched any of their content. I will say, I've been able to do something for you, and I've been able to watch The Leftovers.
Yeah,
still slowly into it.
Season one's tough, man. Season one is tough to get through. It's just a heavy show.
Especially right now in the world, I'm like, I'm gonna watch one episode, give it a few days, watch another episode.
I mean, I'm not gonna say the show ever gets like light, but they really like embrace the weirdness of it in two and three, and it makes it, I think it makes it more bingeable. Like I've rewatched all the seasons and two and three I can blow through. But one you really do kind of have to sit with.
It's funny because I've only watched three episodes, and someone on Instagram was asking for recommendation, or she said, "I'll give you guys recommendations." Like, hey, what should I watch? And then she asked me like, what am I watching? What should I be watching? I was like, well, I'm watching The Leftovers right now, and she's like, oh, I'm putting it on my list. And I'm like, I haven't watched a full season, and someone's already taken my recommendation to watch The Leftovers. Okay, cool.
Oh, I also, if we're saying what we've been watching, I read an article the other day that said that if you are the type of person who enjoys the aesthetics of Wes Anderson, you may find his films particularly soothing currently because the sense of control that he enacts throughout his films may help you feel soothed in an out-of-control time. So,
that's interesting.
So we watched Royal Tenenbaums, which is my favorite of all of his movies. We watched that yesterday. It was a very nice like afternoon rewatch.
Yeah, I asked this in our group text because it's a weird time where like I find myself not sure like what I'm like more willing to watch right now. Like I feel like I've been trying to watch more comedies in this moment in time. I binged watched AP Bio for some reason.
Oh, I really liked AP Bio. Always Sunny spin-off kind of thing. So.
Yeah. I liked it, and I was just like, watched like the first two seasons. I think they're coming out with a third season on NBC streaming service Peacock, which comes out, I think, in April. But Yeah, it's like I find myself, in some cases, like going for the comfort viewing over the challenging like dramas, if that makes sense. Like how are you? Like how are you doing that? Like, are you just kind of jumping from like genre to genre?
Yeah, I mean, I
new
think
stuff rewatches.
I think as far as like the television I've had on while I'm working, which is kind of the majority of content I've been consuming right
yeah.
now. I kind of just steer towards comedies because it's not something I feel the need to be looking at. You know,
yeah,
it's almost as much audio as visual for a lot of that
yeah.
stuff. So that's just kind of the way that I've been tending that way, but I haven't noticed, you know, especially I haven't watched a whole lot of film just because I outside of my like work hours, I've been
yeah.
trying to kind of do other stuff. But as far as like television, I haven't like steered away from dramas or anything. I haven't necessarily noticed anything's better than the news right now, you know? So
this is very true. But so for the first half of this episode, we wanted to kind of take questions from the audience, and there are a variety of topics to these questions. So let's get into it. Let's listen to our first question from one of our listeners.
Hey guys, Jonathan here. Really big fan of the show, and I really appreciate the new format you guys are following. My question differs a little bit from the narrative film that you guys tend to cover. So my question is, what is a documentary that has changed your perspective on something or has really just made you approach a topic very differently? If you have one, what's the name of the doc and what topic does it cover? Thanks, guys. Look forward to your answer. Bye.
Thank you, Jonathan. Return caller. Some of these calls will be return callers. Some of them are new. Thomas, do you have an answer for this?
Yeah. It's kind of, it's not going to be the most poignant documentary or feeling, but it felt very poignant for me at the time. It wasn't long after I'd moved to Los Angeles, and I went to a screening of a documentary called City of Gold, which was a documentary about the restaurant critic Jonathan Gold, who used to write for the LA Times. He's since passed away. But it was about how he had kind of redefined the entire food critic, the practice of food criticism, and also how he had defined the restaurant industry in LA, because it's a really unique restaurant industry. And when I moved out to LA, I came from working in the restaurant industry and restaurant PR in Charleston. And so I was really used to the way the restaurant industry was in Charleston, which is a very East Coast. You've got these famous chefs, and they open up new restaurants, and everybody talks about the new restaurants, and even the places that are smaller kind of become famous, and you know, you'll start to gain a following. We had a kind of gullah restaurant in Charleston that was just kind of a hole in the wall, and then like Oprah did a piece on it, and it's as famous as anything else in Charleston now. And mm-hmm. and Jonathan Gold kind of changed LA in general. Is just so many restaurants, and they're all tucked into like strip malls, and you can't,
yeah.
it's hard to judge. You can't really judge a restaurant based on the space, and a lot of them you won't have heard of. And Jonathan Gold kind of changed the industry by being the person who would go into a strip mall, by being the person who would drive like 30 minutes outside of LA to go eat somewhere in like a suburb of Los Angeles. And it really changed the industry at the time. He kind of started in the mid 80s. When there was a really like the kind of yuppie, like everything was French. All the restaurants in New York were like upscale French restaurants. Mm-hmm. Everyone was obsessed with like the French laundromat, or the French laundry, not the French laundromat, which was like a very fine French restaurant in the in California wine country. And he was one of the first people to really embrace other cultures, other food cultures outside of like fine French dining or Italian or anything like that. So it's a really, really cool doc. They take him back. They follow him as he is reviewing new restaurants, but then they also take him back to some of the restaurants that he made successful with his
uh-huh.
reviews, and interview the families that own those restaurants about how he changed their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it ultimately becomes this whole kind of love letter to Los Angeles culture and a love letter to this man and the way that he has defined, not defined Los Angeles culture, but like held a microphone up to it
yeah.
and helped other people appreciate it. And I went to that screening and he was there and he spoke, and I remember driving back from the USC's campus back to my house and like looking at the streets of LA in a new way, because there's so many little places you never even like give a second glance.
Yeah, it's like there's a place near the video store called like Bombay Frankie's, which is like an Indian place. It's in a gas station, and it's like it's being called one of the best Indian restaurants in the city, or even like in Culver City, part of the LA. There's like a Zoe's Cookies or Zoe's Cookies in a gas station as well, and it's like one of the best cookie places in all of Los Angeles. Like these weird like between like in these nooks and crannies of Los Angeles of just kind of like good cuisine or good food, good snacks, like whatever you can find. And you don't really, I mean, I feel like you have that in a lot of major cities, but it isn't as showcased as well.
Yeah. I think that's 'cause LA is a city of strip malls.
Yeah.
More so than any other city. So, you know, you might be able to judge something in another city by like what tower it gets, you know, what building it gets into, you know, what's coming to the first floor of like so-and-so building. And in LA in particular, you know, if you have a strip mall with like a hair place and a liquor store, and then this Cambodian restaurant, like there's no way of knowing until you try it. And that's kind of what Jonathan Gold was starting to, he was the guy who was going to start trying that. And he was never going to try every restaurant in the city. So, in essence, he was saying, come try these places that I tell you are great, but also he was setting an example that you could go try places on your own.
I need to watch that. It's on my watch list now, so I'll go look at it. I kind of have, so, two things. One's a documentary, one's a docuseries. The documentary I won't spend much time on. I watched it. It was one of the first, I guess growing up in Alabama, documentaries weren't really a form of filmmaking that I saw. Like, it wasn't coming to our theater. It really wasn't on television that much. So one of the first kind of introductions I had to documentary was when I went to University of Alabama and took a couple classes on filmmaking, or and specifically like genres of filmmaking. So one movie that was showed in my film criticism class to teach documentary, and then another one was in my documentary kind of form class. They use this one, and it's a movie called Jesus Camp. Have you seen this movie?
I have seen pieces. I've never sat down and watched it all the way through. But
yeah, apparently they're just like, hey, these Alabama kids need to watch Jesus Camp. And I watched like twice. It was weird. It was a movie that each class used as a way to teach the documentary form. For those who know, Jesus Camp is basically about this Christian summer camp led by this specific lady. I think it's Pentecostal is what it is. I want to make sure. I don't want to throw a denomination under the bus real quick. The name is Pentecostal. Okay, I'm not crazy. Pentecostal summer camp called Kids on Fire School of Ministry. Right there, that shows this is a weird movie. This shows you just kind of like how far any group of religion can become, or any branch of religion can become. And it was these Christians who kind of felt that they were trying to take back America because America was taken away from them, which I think is very relevant today. And it was essentially they believed they should kind of be like preparing their kids for like a religious war. Based on the summer camp, you're following three kind of kids who are going to this Christian summer camp and just kind of seeing what they're being taught by this lady, this preacher, who is, name escapes me, Becky Fisher is her name. And it was just kind of an eye-opening experience, of especially being like a Christian from Alabama and seeing how far someone could go with a specific thing. I some of the I'd seen in like friends of mine with certain churches where I was from, it was like there's one scene where like a guy talks about how he can't watch Harry Potter because it's the devil, and I remember thinking, well, I know people like that. But Jesus Camp was kind of just an eye-opening experience of kind of a specific group of people that I was unaware of. It was painting a bad portrait of Christianity in a way we've talked about in our faith-based movies. Just to bring it with that, is that it was just kind of showcasing a part of Christianity that did not represent the whole, but was being taken as as like the whole for some people. The other one that I just recently watched was a docuseries, and that was Cheer on Netflix, the cheerleading. I'm going to be real. Because when I first started watching it, I started watching it kind of as a joke. Like, Euthana, Derek, and I were watching it at their place. And we just kind of, let's just put this on in the background. I bet this is going to be, like, weird and kind of just, like, a bunch of cheerleaders or whatever. I was completely wrong. Highly entertaining. I was totally in on the Texas cheerleading drama. It was like Friday Night Lights, but with cheerleaders. I enjoyed it. I shouldn't have taken it at, like, I just thought it was going to be, like, a funny high school or our college, like comedy drama or whatever for some reason. I thought it was where they were focusing a docuseries on cheerleaders, and I was wrong in terms of how competitive it was and how dramatic it was in a good way. I even got, like, called out on Letterboxd because I put it on my diary. That was the one where they were just like, this is a TV show. You can't put this on here. Take it off. And I'm like, what? I watched this. Calm down. It was good. Watch it. And everyone I've talked to that has seen it, I don't know if you've seen it, Thomas, has highly enjoyed it. So it's on Netflix. You can stream it. I was wrong. I took it at face value, and I was stupid. Anyway, Jonathan, thank you so much for the question. Hopefully that answered it. Also, going off that, what's your favorite documentary? This is a side question. Do you have a favorite documentary?
You know, I think another thing, this is also experiential, mm-hmm. but when I think of just documentaries and my experience with documentaries, I think about the first time I saw Tickled. And when the director came in the emergency exit and to do a Q&A afterwards because he said he couldn't travel. He had to travel in secret because he was being harassed so much by the subjects of it. I just, that was insane. That I had no idea what that movie was going to be about going into it. I just heard a lot of buzz and it was wild.
I still need to watch that.
Yeah.
Because one of the guys showed up, because I showed it at the New Art.
Yeah.
The video store. And he went to do a Q&A. And, like, one of the guys who was in it showed up. And it was, like, an hour-long, like, back and forth in the Q&A. And someone videoed it and put it on YouTube. So it's there. Yeah. My favorite would be Hoop Dreams. I really loved Hoop Dreams when I first saw it. It's a long, kind of three-hour epic about these... the director followed these two kids from like eighth grade to freshman year of college. Started off as supposed to be like a 9-minute PBS, like little, just kind of like a show, like a story. And it turned into a 3-hour documentary that showcased kind of like a certain part of America that wasn't being showcased. And it wasn't just about basketball, but kind of the dreams of these kids, but also the dreams of their family and family issues and financial stuff in America. Yeah, worth watching as well. I think it's on Criterion or HBO. I think it's on HBO actually as well. So you can watch Tickled and Hoop Dreams on HBO Go, guys. Good double feature. Anyway, here time for our next question of the episode.
Hey, this is Jordan Letson. I was calling to ask you fellas what you think the most overrated director is, the most underrated director is, and what movie in the Criterion do you think should be removed? Like, what do you think is just absolutely worthless and doesn't actually hold water now anymore? And what do you think should be added to it? All right. I hope one of these questions makes it. Anyway, have a good one. Stay safe. Wash your hands. Bye.
Jordan, thank you so much for the call. First time caller. A lot of questions there to unpack there, Thomas.
Yeah.
Which one do you want to take first?
We can take them as they came. All right. Directors first.
Okay.
Overrated.
Uh-huh. I fucking know what you're going to say.
Noah Baumbach.
I knew it. Okay. Why Noah Baumbach there, Thomas?
I don't know how he has become as popular as he is. And I think it is because of his collaborations with Greta Gerwig, who is immensely more talented than he is. I think, I mean, if you look at his track record, he was kicking around for a while, not doing anything, like, really. The people who are loyal to Noah Baumbach were people who were of the age of the characters in Kicking and Screaming when Kicking and Screaming came out. There's a very devoted fan base that movie, like, graduating from college. If you were graduating from college the year Kicking and Screaming came out and you saw it, mm-hmm. I know a lot of people who are, like, devoted to him because of that. But outside of that, I think most of his fans came to him during his period working with Greta Gerwig, which I still don't really like that much, and I think she's much better off without him. Mm-hmm. I think she gets enough praise. I wouldn't necessarily call her an underrated director, but she deserves all of it. She is incredible. Mm-hmm. I think that he kind of makes the same movie over and over again, like New York Malaise. There's only so much New York Malaise I can watch. We've already had decades of that from Woody Allen.
Yeah.
But my main problem with him is I think he's a fine writer. I don't think he's a very good director at all. I think he takes very talented actors, and I don't know what his directing process is like, but I have never really liked a performance from an actor that I like in his movies. That includes Greta Gerwig. That includes Laura Dern, who just won an Academy Award for being in one of his films, in which she had two monologues, and that was it. And speaking of monologues, that's what all of his films feel like, people monologuing at each other. I don't know what he tells his actors, but actors who are normally great at conversation are not having conversations in his movies. They are talking at each other. That scene that is popping up on my Facebook every single day during Oscar season of Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver yelling at each other.
I hope you die.
They're not listening to each other, yeah. Which, I mean, you can say is part of the plot. I think that's part of the reason why Marriage Story works better than most of his movies, because I guess part of the plot is that mm-hmm. no one is communicating. But he doesn't even, if you go back and watch that scene from when Scarlett Johansson comes through the door, he's not even shooting their eye lines right. They're not even making mm-hmm. eye contact with each other. And that happens in almost all of his scenes. And he does this scene with Laura Dern and Scarlett Johansson in a one shot where they're sitting on the couch talking, and Scarlett Johansson gets up and helps herself to a Kleenex and goes in the bathroom and flushes the Kleenex down and comes back. And it's just, none of it feels natural. It just feels like he's trying to give her business. And that's the way I feel watching any of his films. I never feel, it doesn't feel like a choice. It doesn't feel uh-huh. strong enough to be a choice, kind of like a Wes Anderson, where people are deadpan and not real. I mean, there are very real moments in Wes Anderson's films.
Yeah.
And I think the kind of this sometimes deadpan where people aren't communicating with each other enhances those moments when they are finally connecting.
Yeah.
But I never feel that with his movies.
Mm-hmm.
I think he makes good actors worse, and I think that is the very definition of a not good director.
You have held this stance for a number of years,
and I continue to watch his movies. I continue to give him, every time one comes out and people praise it, I continue to go, okay, well, let's give it another shot. And Marriage Story was probably the best of his movies so far, but I think only because there's that little bit of justification that I guess they aren't having a conversation because their marriage is breaking down. But that's it.
Have you seen Meyerowitz Stories?
I have.
Okay. Never mind then. I will say with Meg, because he is actually on my list as well currently. Not as much as he once was. I feel like, because it's been brought up to me, like, anytime I review one of his movies, I always start with, I'm not a big Noah Baumbach fan, but I kind of like this movie. So I'd say with Meyerowitz and Marriage Story, they're not movies I really love, but they have gotten better. Jordan, to go with your question about Criterion Collection, I do not like Kicking and Screaming at all, and it is on the Criterion Collection. I get that people like it. I don't get it. that's not my answer to your question, though, but I'm just going to throw that one out there. Yeah, he's on my list. I also put Michael Bay on my list. I don't know if he's overrated or whatever. Like, I think
he's gone to the point where he's become too maligned.
Okay.
As a director, as a producer, yeah, he's put a lot of bad content out into the world. But as a director, yeah. I think if you go back to, you go back to his two Criterion films, Armageddon and The Rock.
Which I will also say Armageddon should not be a Criterion film. That was my answer.
I think you got to leave it. I think if you go back to True Bayhem, no one had ever done anything like it before.
I'll give you The Rock. I'll give you. I don't know, man. Anyway, overrated. I also put George Lucas on my list.
Oh yeah, I've been rewatching the prequels. He's awful.
I put George Lucas on my list just because
I think he's a great writer producer. He's a good director.
I think American Graffiti is a masterpiece. That's one of my favorite films of all times. But I think in terms of if you look at the ratio of movies, it's THX, American Graffiti, Star Wars: New Hope, and then the prequels.
I mentioned this to my girlfriend. We were watching Attack of the Clones recently, mm-hmm. which is miserable. Yeah. And it's interesting that he's never done television because I think he would be a great showrunner.
I would agree with that.
That's essentially what he did with the original Star Wars films.
Yeah, that's what he was.
He was picking and Indiana Jones too. He was in the writer's room. He was sharing a writer's credit with other people, and he was picking directors that he thought could continue his vision.
Yeah.
And that obviously worked incredibly well, especially for Empire. And he's a famously great producer, incredible business sense, great VFX supervisor. But how you can take someone as good as Natalie Portman and make her as bad as she is in that movie has to be the director. It absolutely must be the director and the script.
But also, that's the first time where he was, or the first Star Wars film, I think, outside. Did he have a writer on A New Hope? I can't remember if he did or not, if it was just him. But, like, all the prequels were written and directed by him, solely by him. And I think that's the first time since maybe A New Hope that had happened. And the prequel series proves to me that directing Rust is a real thing. Hmm. Like, he hadn't directed since A New Hope, and he comes back 20 years later and does that. But I think in terms of if you have six movies, and I haven't seen THX, but benefit of the doubt here, three good movies and three bad. What did you think of Revenge of the Sith? You rewatched Revenge of the Sith. What were your thoughts on that one?
The problems from Attack of the Clones are still there. Natalie Portman and Hayden Christensen are both still bad. I think the reason that people remember Revenge of the Sith well is there is a noticeable improvement in the visual effects between Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith. And Ewan McGregor, who is incredible in the whole series, who's giving it his all, is given more screen time in that one than he was in Attack of the Clones.
Yeah.
And I think that's the reason people remember it fondly. But I mean, Samuel Jackson is struggling in this movie. Like, everyone is really, you can feel them struggling under the script and under acting entirely in front of a green screen. It must have just been so difficult, and that is where the director needs to step in and help bring those performances out, and they did not show up.
Yeah, because those movies were kind of the first, not the first ones, but were very big in terms of using special effects, in terms of like so much was in front of a green screen.
Mm-hmm.
Or I think he used blue screen at that point. I'm not entirely sure. But it was like that was that and maybe The Matrix, but I think even The Matrix was done kind of some on-set stuff. But yeah, Star Wars just feels all the prequel series feels like that. Yeah, Lucas is on my list for overrated. So underrated, who do you have?
I don't want to my number one answer I don't want to blow right now because we're going to be doing an episode all about this director very soon, so I'm going to put that one in my pocket.
Uh-huh.
Someone we've talked about a lot recently, and I've already talked about once on this episode, I think, is David Gordon Green.
I agree with that.
And I think as we'll discuss in our next director episode, I think if you really... I think the danger of auteur theory is if you really show range and utility, if you are able to make something considered artistic but also make something that needs to be done, you know, make a sitcom, I think people will tend to overlook you, or make a you know, mid-budget horror film. But David Gordon Green has done some incredible dramas.
Yeah.
And has been attached to, I think, some incredible television comedies. And yeah. I think always brings a touch of... It's not necessarily something you can pinpoint. It would be hard to dissect him as an auteur as far as his style. But I just think he brings a sensibility that everything that he makes, no matter how ridiculous it is or no matter how far out there it is, he grounds almost everything he's attached to. Your Highness, I still can't really vouch for, but he can ground almost anything else. I've always admired his ability to just kind of jump back and forth between whatever he's interested in and make a movie with his buddy, make a comedy with his buddies, and then make something as great as, you know, his early indie dramas or even Stronger, which I've talked about several times on the podcast. I've thoroughly enjoyed almost every project he's been attached to across lots of mediums, and I've always admired his exploration of different mediums.
I love David Gordon Green. I feel like we could do just a David Gordon Green podcast, like not just an episode, but entire podcast on David Gordon Green's work if we want to. But yeah, it's he's a guy who has gone from genre to genre, from locale to locale in a way too, where he can do these kind of small town dramas, but also in a way small town comedies. I think that's what he's showing with the stuff with HBO, with Dan. Well, Dan McBride's doing it, but like he's directing some of the episodes with Righteous Gemstones and Vice Principals. And then you have something like Stronger, Joe, which I think is one of Cage's best films that goes overlooked a lot of the times. And then now he's in this kind of, in terms of film, he's in this horror world with Halloween. And he had Halloween, reboot, sequel, whatever you want to call it, and then he's doing two more Halloween films. So it's like he's in film world, he's tied up in the horror genre, and then in TV, he's coming back and doing comedies. I'll say the one you're going to say real quick. I won't go into it as well, but Peter Weir was one of mine, which is the one we're going to talk about in later episodes. We won't delve into that was supposed to be this episode, but Thomas and I both love Peter Weir, so we'll leave it for that. I also put, to kind of go with David Gordon Green, he might not be seen as underrated. I've gotten to debates people because they say, oh, he's highly rated, but is Rob Reiner? Because I think why I say Reiner is because in the 80s, he had one of the craziest stretches I've ever seen in terms of directing, in terms of like financial success and critical success, where, and all kind of within different genres was the thing. With movies like When Harry Met Sally, Princess Bride, Stand By Me, Misery, A Few Good Men, like he went on a crazy tear in the 80s into early 90s, and I think gets kind of overlooked because of his later films that aren't as good and have kind of become like almost direct-to-video type films.
I think he's also someone who jumps genre so much that I think it's hard to pinpoint.
Yeah, it is.
A style. I think that can kind of take away from the way people think about them as like a singular...
Yeah.
Creator.
But I really think with, because you go from This Is Spinal Tap, he does The Sure Thing, which I think is an underrated movie. Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, and A Few Good Men. And I think he doesn't get as talked about as some of his other 80s peers. Like, I guess because he never really had that big hit in the 90s outside of A Few Good Men. And because I think it's that his movies all kind of, I guess they all start kind of falling into similar categories where and this is just kind of a thing in Hollywood, is that all of his films are starting to kind of deal with older characters, and in Hollywood, older characters, older actors aren't used as much, and they're not marketable, they're not as really profitable, so that's kind of why he kind of aged out of it. But when you look in that 80s period, I think that's one of the best periods of a director I've seen in a while, that just kind of hit after hit after hit, all different genres pretty much, and or all different tones is a better way to put it. But yeah, that's my underrated stuff. Criterion. I feel like I know why Jordan put this question, because we watched a movie that was on the part of the Criterion collection that I didn't really like.
Part of the collection or part of the channel?
Collection.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, then you lead, because I've got a couple. I'm deep in Criterion world right now with my rewatch project or whatever. But
I've said Kicking and Screaming. I've said Armageddon. Sorry. I feel like I'll settle with The Rock. The Rock's fine, and that's because it's named The Rock. But I'm kidding. But the one for me that I know Jordan was referencing, I believe she was referencing because we watched this in our group, is a movie called Eating Raoul. Did not really like it. It's kind of this. It was Paul Bartel. A lot of people love him. I think he's a funny actor. I didn't really like the movie. It was just kind of like it was one of our biggest busts in terms of our movie watching group.
Mm-hmm.
Where like no one liked it. And it's about a married couple. Paul Bartel was an actor who worked in a lot of Roger Corman movies. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of, I think his, I don't know if it was his debut or one of his first directing films. And it's about this married couple, kind of prudish married couple who like want to buy a restaurant, but they don't have the money for it. So it's like very like Sweeney Todd-esque, where they start like killing off swingers. So they basically set up the wife to have sex with these men. The men come over, and then the husband kills them all. And they rob them and take the money and use it to like buy their restaurant. I did not like it. No one in our group liked it. It's on the Criterion in the Criterion collection. I did not get it. I feel like there was better films to do out of the Corman group of people than that one. So yeah, I'll end it there. But yeah, I also say Armageddon. I also say Kicking and Screaming. But I'll let you go ahead, Thomas.
Okay, couple. Here we go. List. Kind of related to that, some stuff that I just think they picked the wrong film from a certain. Like I understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honoring like a certain director or preserving a certain director's work. Chasing Amy is in the Criterion collection.
It is.
And I feel like if you're. Because you have to think when you're thinking Criterion, like, what are they trying to preserve here? And I think they're trying to capture that, like, Miramax period in, like, the early 90s. Where
Indie drama.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dramedies.
Yeah, and I think you just go with Clerks, if that's what you're doing. If you're trying to preserve something for history, I think you just put Clerks on there. Then neither of them are necessarily movies that I love.
Yeah,
but I can recognize, you know, trying to preserve that specific period in film, which is a very interesting time period.
Mm-hmm.
Benjamin Button.
Yeah,
literally any other David Fincher movie. I think The Game and Benjamin Button are the only two movies he
only
has.
Two. Only two.
So bizarre.
Yeah.
So bizarre. Put Zodiac on there now. and then the other thing, and I've had a lot of conversations about this recently. Because Martin Scorsese is the creator of the Criterion Collection and is the overseer of the Criterion Collection.
Is he?
Yeah.
Or is he just like responsible for like it getting made?
He's responsible for, I don't know that he oversees everything now on a day-to-day basis, but yes, he was responsible for the Criterion Collection and selected The Red Shoes, which was his favorite movie the first entry, right?
I mean, it's not the first entry, no.
But that's his like.
It's one of the first ones.
When he's interviewed, he's like, "That's why I wanted, because the Red Shoes was like in danger of being destroyed, and that's why I wanted to." Am I making all of this up? I swear I've seen an interview with him saying that.
I've never heard this outside of you.
Oh, okay.
So not positive.
Maybe I made it all up. Anyway, I understand. There's this whole thing. Martin Scorsese, streaming, doesn't like streaming stuff. But he did The Irishman. I don't think The Irishman should have just been added to the Criterion Collection. I don't think Marriage Story should have just been added to Criterion Collection. And it feels like a reaction because, and I totally understand this, because we don't know how permanent these films are that are just on Netflix.
Yeah.
And I understand the idea of wanting to get a physical copy stored of that film. And I understand... Yeah. Storing that for history, but I don't think those are the two films that I would choose to pull off of Netflix. That it felt very knee-jerk, and it's always strange when a brand new film is added.
Yeah,
because you don't really know how it's going to age. It's yeah. happened often. A film that's still in theaters here, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, has already been added, which
yeah.
from everything I've heard, it's incredible. But yeah, those two in particular, when they announced both of them, it felt like Scorsese just going, haha, Netflix, you paid for this movie, but now I'm gonna take it off of Netflix, and get the recognition I deserve for it. I don't know, but he only has two feature films on the Criterion Collection currently: Passion of the Christ and The Age of Innocence.
You mean Last Temptation of Christ?
Yes, sorry, I did that last time, didn't I? Last Temptation of Christ and Age of Innocence, but yeah. The Irishman is a weird one to put on there.
Yeah, and to go with that in terms of what should be added, I agree with you. See, I think Chasing Amy is Kevin Smith's best film, but I think Clerks is the more important one.
Yeah, Chasing Amy doesn't necessarily. It's more mainstream. If you're trying to preserve that period, then that's not necessarily the one that does it. Even Mallrats, I feel like is more exemplary of like the indie movement behind it.
Also, we're in a weird period too. I think like so. This is from a buddy of mine, Logan, who's a listener of the show. I don't know how true this is as well in terms of which movies. I know he always told me that like there were certain movies that came out in like late 90s, early 2000s that were like supposed to be Criterion movies, but something happened legally and they didn't get released in a Criterion thing. One of those was like Boogie Nights, and I think Seven was on there. Mm. So like if you look at those like those releases at that point where it's like two disc box set with like loads of features. Allegedly, it was because they were supposed to be Criterions and they weren't. So I ones to be added. I would agree with in terms of I think Zodiac would be one to do. Lost. I mean, it's now considered one of Fincher's best films, but when it was released, was lost in the shuffle in like 2007. Was very overshadowed by There'll Be Blood and No Country for Old Men. Does Paul Thomas Anderson have a Criterion release of any kind?
I think is there not a Magnolia?
No,
.
I don't think he has. I'm trying to think through all of these. He has Punch Drunk Love.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, yep.
Yeah.
I've bought that one. I gave that one to Euthana one time. Okay. Well, and along those lines, my answer is there is the only way you can get The Last Picture Show from the Criterion Collection is to buy it in a box set with a bunch of other films made by that studio, and I think that is ridiculous because there are three other films in that box set that are available on their own, and I do not know why The Last Picture Show, which is one of the greatest films in American film history, does not, if you already have a print of it, if you've already got it within the collection, why are you not manufacturing it in other forms? And I'm sure there's some kind of copyright law or something they didn't work out in the negotiations for it, but please, it is very difficult to get a Blu-ray of The Last Picture Show, and Criterion, I need you to fix this.
So there you go, Criterion. I would love more Billy Wilder. That's personally me, because I think he's one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. And they only have, I think, Ace in the Hole, Some Like It Hot, and that might be it. That might be all the Billy Wilder stuff. Jordan, thank you so much for the question. Hopefully, you answered all four parts of your question in the best way we can. So let's take a listen to the next question, which I think will be kind of a short answer.
Hey, guys. This is Will. I was curious, with the coronavirus shutdown and all the streaming services available, how come you guys have never reviewed anything off of the CBS streaming services? Looking forward to hearing your thoughts on Star Trek Discovery, Star Trek Picard, and, of course, the fantastically reviewed Twilight Zone.
Thomas, you can take this one.
I've probably seen more CBS All Access content than most people as I worked on some of it, but which is also part of the reason why I never brought any of it up. That kind of felt like a conflict of interest, but I no longer work for CBS. And they made it very clear when they took away my CBS All Access password the night that I left the network.
The night? Wow.
I went home. I had my exit interview. I had a party with some of my coworkers, and I got home and I said, I would like to watch an episode of No Activity. And I logged in and it was gone. It was gone.
That was quick.
No Activity I actually love. No Activity is a weird show, but I love it. It's a comedy on CBS All Access that is just made. It's about cops doing surveillance and is told entirely in 2 to 3 person dialogue scenes. The first season centers on two cops, Tim Meadows, and then the creator, who's an Australian comedian, who are watching, who are surveilling a drug stash house. Within the stash house, there are two criminals played by Jesse Plemons and Will Ferrell, who are like waiting in the stash house for some drugs to be delivered. And then two dispatchers, who are, just on the phone lines. And it's you're just watching two-person dialogue scenes play out for every episode, for the whole episode, mm-hmm. just intercutting between these three two-person dialogue scenes, and that it's incredibly well done, and it's so well done that you don't really realize what the gimmick is unless you really look for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's one of those, I think if it played anywhere other than CBS All Access, it would probably have
been
bigger
talked
buzz.
About. Yeah.
Yeah, because the only way you can get buzz on CBS All Access is if you're built off of existing IP. I haven't watched any of The Twilight Zone. That was after they took away my password.
Star Trek?
Star Trek, I have no interest. I've never watched Star Trek. Not a Star Trek person. Zero interest. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry, world. One, I was very... when we were working on the series is... one I was very interested in was called Strange Angel, and it was about I forget what the guy's name was. This is a true story. He was a rocket scientist in LA who was also obsessed with like sex magic, and it's a crazy story in like 1950s, Jack Parsons. 1930s LA. He was a rocket scientist and sex magician, who was also friends with L. Ron Hubbard. There's this crazy story about him and L. Ron Hubbard trying to birth the Antichrist. And I remember, and we were working on this show, and I thought it was going to be wild. And I remember the first review that came out that said like a show about rockets and sex magic should not be this boring. And I was like, oh no, and I watched most of the first season, but yeah, it's CBS. There's a lot of streaming sites are having a tough time figuring out if, because when you're not policed by the FCC and like what you can show on television, it's hard to pinpoint, you know, where are we going to be HBO, or are we going to be Cinemax, where do we draw the line? And I think CBS maybe drew it a little too far. They didn't draw it far enough to make a show about sex magic and rockets.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
And when you look at the, I'm looking at like some of the directors they have, like Ben Wheatley did season one, season two episodes. Yeah. David Lowery did the first two episodes, season one.
Yeah, David Lowery worked on it. David Lowery was a producer on it all the way through. Like I thought this show was going to be huge, and it was not. Another show that when I was working on it was meant to be CBS All Access, and I think benefited from somewhere down the line ending up not being CBS All Access, was Unbelievable, which came out on Netflix not long ago and actually got really good reviews.
I still need to watch that.
That was a CBS project while I was there. Wanted to watch Twilight Zone, but unfortunately no longer have access to. And I can point some fingers and name some names of people who left the company at the same time I did and still have their login.
Wow.
But I won't do it.
Wow. We're drinking some tea today there. Thomas, what's the tea? All right. I have no comments on CBS streaming service. I have not watched it. The thing is, we're in such a crazy midst of like the streaming wars where it's like, I will say this, in the midst of COVID-19, I have added a lot of streaming services that are free for the time being as a way to watch other things. So like,
I can't believe Quibi's 90 days. That's wild.
Yeah, man, that doesn't come out till April, but like, I'm like, I got 90 days of Quibi and I'll be done with it. Once that 90, I feel like I will. I'm sorry if you're listening, Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Have you done Shudder? You texted us about Shudder.
I just signed up for Shudder.
I really like the layout of Shudder. I think it's, I think it's a really cool layout that they separate it by like subgenres. They have three channels that are just like, they have a slasher channel, a monster channel, and it's just like live television. You just click in and a movie's going, and you can leave it on. I think of of the weird little streaming sites, Apple TV Plus sucks. I've been texting you guys this. There's the Apple streaming service, if anything, the design of it should work. Yeah. And it is awful.
Because it's Apple. It's Apple.
It is awful. It's ridiculous how bad it is. And it's really disappointing as an Apple customer.
I haven't explored Apple TV yet. I did just get Canopy finally last night. I had to sign up for like an online library card to get Canopy because I was like, I really want to try out Canopy because there's a couple things they're like they're giving you recommends and a lot of it's on Canopy, and so I wanted to explore that one. Shudder was one I did just get for that, and I haven't explored Shudder yet. I'm trying to do like with all these streaming services now that I have time, I'm kind of trying to watch like a movie per streaming service, like to where I'm not just spending time on one service. I'm trying to go from like one, like I watched the Disney Plus one last night, I watched a Campy one today, I watched a Netflix one with like we did a Netflix watch party, so I'm trying to like see how all the services are and what they have. Mm-hmm. To where if I want to keep one or cancel one, I gotta get back on the Criterion Collection stuff that we've been doing, because I haven't watched one from there in like about a week or so. Yeah, maybe I'll try CBS at some point. I feel like the shows that would give me interest in CBS All Access are the things like you're talking about, No Activity, that no one talks about.
Mm-hmm.
That I would enjoy. Like, I'm not a big Star Trek fan, so that doesn't interest me at all. Twilight Zone does, just because it's Jordan Peele. But I didn't hear, the reviews weren't that great for it.
There was like a little bit of hype, and then I feel like the reviews weren't awesome. Everyone saw that first episode they put out free on YouTube, and then I don't even know any of the other episodes. I just know the Kumail Nanjiani one.
And that, because that was the,
Stand-up comedian one.
So yeah, Will, I hope that answers your question. I believe you did that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but okay. Yeah, on to our next question of the episode.
Hey, it's Ray here, and I have a question. If you were to be turned into any gremlin, which gremlin would you want to be turned into? You have a vegetable gremlin, the Brainiac gremlin, the electric gremlin, the girl gremlin, the bat gremlin, phantom gremlin, spider gremlin. So yeah, which gremlin would you want to be turned into? Goodbye.
Ray, thank you for the question. So, Gremlins, a series directed by Joe Dante, who I just had a conversation with someone recently who didn't know who Joe Dante was, and I had to break down kind of the films he did in the 80s, and Gremlins 1 and 2 was one of them. I have not seen Gremlins 2, which I think is where a lot of these people...
pretty much... there's only one gremlin, really, in the first Gremlins movie.
In the Gremlins 1.
Stripes.
I know Ray, who called, is Gremlins 2 is one of his favorite movies of all time. So I had to do some research on the Gremlins and read some articles about what type of gremlins there are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go with the Brainiac Gremlin, for me. That's the one I would want to be turned into. He's smart. Develops a human voice. So yeah, that's mine.
Okay, I'm gonna break the rules of the question a little bit. Because I have seen Gremlins 2, but I did not have it growing up. I had a VHS of the first one. Mm-hmm. I did not have a VHS of the second one. So I'm in keeping with saying what the movies and the characters mean to us, I'm gonna say that I personally always felt that I myself was Barney the dog. He's not super interested in the gremlins, but he likes Gizmo and he likes the main character, and he, you know what, in the end he rides for his boys, and he's there, he's backing Gizmo up in the store, and he's a good dog, and he protects everyone. He's ready to fight those gremlins. He's one of the first people to be. He and Gizmo are both like very wary of the new Mogwai before they turn into gremlins. I'm just shout out. That's me. If we're picking characters, sorry Ray, I broke the rules a little bit, but I gotta go where my heart tells me to go.
Barney the Dog. Okay. Is he in the first one or and second one or just the first one?
I think he's just in the first one. I don't even know. I don't even remember if he's in the second one. I've only seen the second one like twice.
Yeah, I've never seen the second one. I had the first one until like a year or two ago. But
no, I did. I was raised on the first one. I had the first one. I loved it. It terrified me, but I loved it.
Okay. Well, I like Joe Dante. Just for anyone, I feel like one of the bigger inspirations of Stranger Things. I know everyone kind of pinpoint Spielberg movies, but I think Dante films are like were a heavily influenced Stranger Things with movies like, I mean, Explorers, even The Burbs. Like Dante was kind of this, or is and was this, a director who kind of focused on like movies in suburban life and kind of the oddness to suburban life and what will happen if something crazy happens, like your next door neighbors are murderers or aliens have come down from outer space or small action figures have come to life. Like, it's very much that. But yeah, Ray, thanks so much for the question. Hopefully I answered your question some way, even though Barney the Dog's not a gremlin, but oh well. On to our next question.
Hey guys, this is Hunter Barcroft, longtime podcaster, though not anymore. I'm on day 8 of my coronavirus quarantine. I'm sitting on my porch drinking the Corona Light and just shot my bow as a FaceTime Brandon. But calling in, the question is, how do you think COVID-19 and coronavirus in general is going to change our industry? I mean, it's changed it drastically overnight here for us in Atlanta. But as a whole, how do you see this changing the entertainment industry and the film business in general? Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Thank you, Hunter, for your very detailed story of where you're at. I appreciate that. Big question here, and kind of first legit COVID-19 question we've gotten here. Thomas, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think we're going to see studios realizing that there is more money to be made to, like, straight to demand than they had previously thought. We've always kind of got this like straight to DVD, straight to VHS. That's always feels kind of like a curse. It's like, oh, that's straight to DVD. We always think films have to have a theater run. And now it's gone to like straight to Netflix. You've either got a theater run or you're straight to Netflix. And I think studios are going to start to realize that some of your smaller stuff you can push to VOD. If you do a solid push, it might do better than a theater run and might save you some of your money.
Yeah.
But I also think on the other side, I think we're going to see, like, we've already seen this with kind of the Netflix parties and stuff going around. I think we're going to see people who might not have valued the theater experience start to realize how much they miss the theater experience, especially if it comes to if the theaters are locked down long enough for some of these bigger blockbusters to need to be released on VOD. Realizing that sitting by yourself and watching the latest Marvel movie isn't necessarily the experience that you wanted for a big blockbuster. Which has always been the thing, you know, as streaming comes up and as VOD comes up, people are always pointing to, no matter how big your TV gets, you're not going to replicate sitting in a theater and watching a big blockbuster. And no. I think more people are going to realize this, and I think we might see, once we are back sitting in theaters, I think you might see more people valuing that experience.
Yeah, I think it, depending on how long it takes the theaters to open back up. I mean, I think too with these big blockbusters is that, I don't know if this will happen, but I have a feeling studios might actually start making smaller films that could be released in theaters and on VOD at the same time. So I do think you're going to see more day and date releases after this point. I think studios might not invest too heavily in movies as much, or in terms of like a $300 million blockbuster. I think it could be less. I think because hopefully nothing like this happens again, but in case it does, what you don't want is something like Black Widow to essentially sit on the shelf for a year because you want to make sure you make your money back. Mm-hmm. Because with something like Lovebirds, for example, that Paramount just sold to Netflix, they've made their money back probably already by selling it to Netflix, and now Netflix has a movie they can show. I feel like you could see budgets decrease, and you might see more mid-budget movies. I agree with you that I think some movies will end up having a better life on VOD. I think more people have watched The Hunt on my Letterboxd in terms of like on VOD than they did when it was in theaters. I think it'll be a good place for certain films like that. And I do think you're going to see my AMC app was like giving me, hey, you can purchase these movies right now through our AMC streaming service. And I'm like, wait, when did they have a streaming service I could purchase movies through? And yeah. So I feel like you're going to see stuff like that. Also, I think depending on how long this takes, this is going to actually, I think the closest thing we've had in this industry that's similar to this is the writer strike in 07 to 08. Where it affected essentially things for years. I think this will. I think you're about to start to see a lot of movies now that have been canceled are going to stockpile for the rest of the year in terms of theaters. So you're going to, I mean, I think Fast and the Furious was probably the smartest. They're like, hey, we're going to chalk this up as a loss and we'll release it in a year from now. But now you're having things like Black Widow, Quiet Place, and a couple others that I'm blanking on that have been pushed back indefinitely, and we don't know when they're going to be released. And so when they pick a date for like the summer, what movie does that put out of the place? Mm-hmm. So you're going to start seeing like New Mutants has been pushed back three different times. Where is that going to go? Is Disney just going to cut their losses and actually put that on Hulu, or are they going to like move something back from their release schedule to put New Mutants there? So I think you're going to see things like how is this going to change not just our summer release schedule, but how will it change our fall and winter release schedule? It's going to push our schedule back for 6 months or a year. So I think that will have a big effect. And I don't think people are talking about that right now. I think, like you said, I think how we view content will change, where people will either rely heavily on the theater experience now and realize they missed it, or some people will just go straight to streaming and realize how much they can get through streaming with everything out there. It's a good time to be a streaming service right now. I've noticed on Letterboxd, just with every movie I'm watching, someone has just watched it. Even no matter how, like, 150 people have watched this movie the entire time Letterboxd's been around, but I've seen someone who's watched it the day before I did. Because people are just trying to consume as much content right now. It's a good time to be maybe Quibi and Peacock and HBO, because they're going to be releasing their streaming service in the midst of this, so people will want to get new content. Only issue is, will they be able to pay for it? And then, yeah, I think it's going to change a lot. I think, and then also just production right now. The thing is, too, that we're not talking about is that movies that were in production are now not in production. Our movies that are about to be in production don't know when they're going to start yet. So you're going to see this even stockpiled movies that's coming out next year be pushed back even further. It's going to have a big impact. I think once this calms down, there'll be so much work that people have to catch up on that you'll see a lot more film jobs open up. But it's going to have a lasting effect on our industry for, I think, years to come. That was depressing. I'm sorry.
Too real.
But yeah, that's how I feel. Anything else you want to add on that, Thomas?
No, I think that covers it, man.
Hunter, thank you so much for giving us that question, and thank you for calling. We hope you're enjoying your bow and arrow and Coronas and all that good stuff. For our final question of this section, here it is.
Hey, Cine Nation, this is Yusana. My question is, what is your favorite movie soundtrack for a movie that you either don't actually like or have never seen? Thanks.
Thank you, Thana, for that question. A return caller. That's a left turn. Not your favorite soundtrack. What's your favorite soundtrack for a movie you don't like or have never seen? Do you have your answer ready, Thomas?
Yeah, I think there's a couple.
Okay.
I could say there's some that the movie itself hasn't aged as well as the soundtrack.
Okay.
I think Garden State is one that a lot of people would agree with, and that was a movie that maybe did well because of its soundtrack, and the soundtrack still holds up and the movie doesn't. I recently, another movie that I had good feelings about because of the soundtrack, I think, was Into the Wild, and I recently revisited it and didn't care for it as much as I did when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then still really love the Eddie Vedder soundtrack that he did for that. But the one that really sticks out to me that I like did not like the movie the first time I saw it, but went like, oh, this is a really cool soundtrack, is the I Am Sam soundtrack. So I Am Sam is entirely, if you know the movie, if you know Tropic Thunder, how they talk about
the movie.
It's about a mentally handicapped man, and he, and something in the within the movie is that he loves the Beatles. And so what they did for the movie, instead of spending their entire budget on getting Beatles songs, which is almost impossible, they had a bunch of musicians cover Beatles songs. But and you know, sometimes that can feel kind of cheap, but it works in this movie, and they got some really, like, Eddie Vedder again, and Ben Folds, and they, it's some really like thoughtful covers that I still like to revisit every once in a while. And the movie is awful, but but the soundtrack I've always really enjoyed.
You're right. It's all the Black Crowes, Ben Folds, Sheryl Crow, Ben Harper.
It's worth checking out.
Nick Cave. So mine is Blues Brothers 2000. Okay. So I love this soundtrack. I've listened to the soundtrack more times than I've seen the movie by a mile. The movie is god awful. And this is coming from someone who Blues Brothers is my favorite film of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And Blues Brothers 2000 is just a travesty. But somehow that soundtrack is amazing. At least to me. I mean, the ending of that movie, which I think was so good. It's like, it's an ending where it's like, it just feels like Dan Aykroyd's like, let me call my buddies I've become friends with over the 20 years. Because I did Blues Brothers, and say, hey, let's get you guys together and do a big, like, huge, like, a finale of Blues Brothers 2000, which, by the way, came out in 98, 2 years before 2000. Anyway, that's a side thing. Yeah, it's like, in the final thing, you have B.B. King, let's see who's in the soundtrack, B.B. King, Dr. John, Wilson Pickett, Eric Clapton, Billy Preston, like, it's just, the list goes on and on and on. Aretha Franklin's back again. Good old Blues Travelers, prime 90s blues rock band. Was my favorite band in freshman year of high school. We all had issues, guys. Yeah, I love that soundtrack. I think it's great, but that movie is just terrible. Have you seen Blues Brothers 2000?
I have not. I've always been told to avoid it, so.
The sad thing is, I saw Blues Brothers 2000 before I saw the Blues Brothers.
Wow.
Yeah, because Blues Brothers 2000 was rated PG-13, and Blues Brothers was rated R. And so I was able to, like, I want to check this out. And I liked it when I first saw it, and then I developed a brain. I'm sorry, that was terrible. I'm sorry if you like Blues Brothers 2000. Yeah, it's bad. It's just like, it's a beat by beat remake of Blues Brothers, but just not good. And you don't have Belushi. So, even though John Goodman does a good job, it's almost like it feels like it should have been a movie that wasn't called Blues Brothers. Like, you could have maybe made a decent movie off this. Maybe not. I have nightmares just thinking about it now. Anyway, that's our last question for this section. If you have a question for us for future episodes, give us a call at 424-256-8254. Again, the number is 424-256-8254. Leave a voicemail ask a question about entertainment. We had a lot of questions today. Could have used that for 6 other episodes, but we won't do that. wanted to do a different episode because of the times we're in, and just kind of answer questions because this is what we had. And our last section, we'll do this hopefully briefly. We wanted to show, because everyone's kind of binging stuff right now. Like, even in the midst of this, I've gotten messages from people saying, "Hey, what can I watch right now?" Like, I've gotten Facebook messages saying, "Like, hey, I love these movies. Give me some recommends." So I thought we should do that to kind of showcase like actors we really love that maybe aren't as talked about as they should be. And from services that are usually they're used by a lot of people or are free services. So yeah, do you want to go like one for you, one for me, and back and forth? Does that work?
Sure, that sounds like a good mix, because you kind of focused on older actors, and I kind of focused on ones who are more, in my opinion, like up and coming, like people to watch.
Yeah. So you go first. Yeah, what's your first one?
My first pick, I think I may have talked about him on the... I know I've talked about him on here before, but Logan Marshall Green.
Yeah.
Is an actor I really like, and I think he was cursed by his first big film debut was Prometheus, which just did not go over very well and didn't really launch. I mean, that was a stacked cast. You go back and look at it, but like none of the people who were really like on the cusp, I feel like got launched from it. But he has since kind of gone back to doing smaller genre stuff, and I think has been fantastic in all of it, and has done great in television as well. Was really excited to see him pop up in Spider-Man, and then he gets killed like 20 minutes into it, unfortunately. The movie I'm going to recommend for it is a horror film directed by Karen Kusama, who is also, I'd like to say, an underrated director, but I really want her to do a couple more things before I make that call, because she made a couple bad movies and then got like banished to like TV world for a while, but did such a good job in TV world that has made her way back into film world and has done great. But anyway, yeah, check out The Invitation. It's on Netflix. It's a horror film, but it's a really, really fun, slow burn. It feels like very Hitchcockian about a dinner party where a man is seeing his ex-wife for the first time, and there's a lot of tensions because of that. But then it's also is he paranoid because of seeing her for the first time, or is something else going on? Yeah. And is really, really well done chamber horror, you know, all kind of set in one house.
Yeah.
And I think he's fantastic in it. I think he really pulls off. And he's also done a movie called Upgrade, which I think I've talked about in our Revenge episode. But he's awesome in that as well. And would love to see more stuff from him in the future.
Yeah. I second The Invitation. That was one that it came to the video store and was kind of like talked about and passed around for a bit, just because it was... I think it's one of the more underrated horror films of the past few years. Like I think it's up there... And I'm excited to see what Kusama does next. Even though did she like an anthology movie with people, I thought, at one point, post that?
She did Destroyer with Nicole Kidman. That was her last.
She did that, which I have not seen.
But she did. She also just did an episode of The Outsider.
Okay.
Which is good.
Did not see Jennifer's Body.
Not a fan.
I feel like that's the one that you're talking about.
Well, then Aeon Flux. Aeon Flux, very famously. Yeah. And it was, I think it was, she was kind of chewed up and spit out by the system that we talk about a lot now, where you have a really promising indie.
Yeah.
And then get thrown into blockbusters, and it did not play out. She got blamed for a lot of the failures, especially for Aeon Flux. But just through, like, absolute grit, worked her way back up the film, the television ladder, and got back, and just kind of, I remember when The Invitation came out and you started hearing good stuff and you're like, Karen Kusama, and then I saw it and it's fantastic. So yeah, if you enjoy horror and you haven't seen that one yet, I've recommended that one to several people who have reached out to me in the past week and been like, what do I watch on Netflix?
So mine, I will say, an actor I love and have loved for many years, who it's talked about, but I don't think in the same regard as some of his peers at the time, or contemporaries, and that's Gene Hackman.
Mm-hmm.
I think Gene Hackman, to me, is one of my favorite actors of all time. I think he's one of the best actors of all time. I have seen him in bad movies, but I've never seen him give a bad performance. And that's really hard to do. I have seen him in just, like, crazy, stupid movies, but I'm like, I believe everything he's saying right now. And Hackman, I think, was, unlike De Niro and certain other actors, he just stopped. He's like, no roles are coming to me that I like. I'm going to retire, move to New Mexico, write some books, and be done with it. When you have people like De Niro and Pacino, who have kind of, De Niro's kind of had the better career of everyone, with pairings with David O. Russell, and then still kind of coming up with The Irishman with Scorsese. But if you look like Pacino hasn't made a good movie in a while. And then The Irishman came out. He'd just been kind of hopping around doing kind of pretty bad, like, mid-budget films when they needed a big star. And I think this past year was his kind of comeback. Dustin Hoffman kind of was a similar thing, and then he's kind of been completely gone. Robert Duvall is a similar thing where he's just kind of popping up in like Christian films occasionally or just low budget films. But Hackman was a guy who I think just knew when to get out. But the movie I wanted to talk about go watch is The Conversation, which is probably one of his greatest films and directed by Francis Ford Coppola. In one of his best films, you know, he made The Godfather 1 and 2 and Apocalypse Now. They just did a restoration of it, and they were supposed to show it at the theater near me in, like, 35mm, and it was, like, coming, I think, this week or next week, but because of the movie's closures, didn't get to see it. But I think in terms of just, like, paranoia and surveillance, which is a kind of the world we're in, it kind of predates our current makeup of how we believe people are listening to us constantly. I think it's a phenomenal film and worth checking out. It's on Amazon Prime and also Pluto TV. Have you tried this, Thomas? Pluto TV, this app?
I haven't.
It's basically a free streaming site. Has like 1,500 movies you can stream, but a lot of like Sunset Boulevard's on there, Short Term 12, The Conversation, and a number of other, let's see what else, Ace in the Hole, Blowout, Sing Street, HUD, like phenomenal movies on here that you should go check out. Maybe there's ads on it, but it's a free service. It's also like live TV as well, so worth checking out. So yeah, Conversation, go watch it. It's great. It's amazing.
Nice. Yeah, my second one is a comedian who I've really enjoyed for a while. I actually worked with her at CBS and was just in awe of her work, and it's one of those things where you're like, you should be doing better things. Mm-hmm. And she has a movie on Netflix, I believe, or maybe Hulu.
Is this Band-Aid? You're about to say Band-Aid.
Yeah. Netflix. Yeah. Zoe Lister-Jones. You may know her if you watched New Girl. She was dated the Schmidt character for a while on New Girl. You may know her if you watched Life in Pieces, but you probably didn't, judging from the numbers we used to get.
Hey, now.
It's great. The first season was great. Second and third season went way downhill. But incredible cast.
Yeah.
But she just made every scene that she... Back when I used to sit and watch dailies for that show, she just made every single take that she was in. She is a fantastic comedic performer. And she wrote and directed this movie called Band-Aid about a husband and wife who are going through like marriage counseling through music. And it's great. Fred Armisen is in it. A really great band called Lucius did the music for it as well. And she wrote and directed it and had an all-female mm-hmm. crew. It's a lot of fun. It's not the best movie ever. It's a fun indie movie, like borderline mumblecore, really. Very small. But
charming. It's charming.
Very charming. Extremely charming. And when you're shuffling through Netflix, if you need something fun and charming and that'll make you smile, pull that one up. And I really, really hope that she has a very strong future ahead of her, because I think she is just absolutely magnetic.
We talked about that, I think, in our...
In our music episode, yeah.
Yeah, I also support that movie, too. And a pretty quick watch as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we're checking out.
Yeah, I don't know if I said Adam Pally plays her husband in it, and who I've been a huge fan of since he was in Happy Endings almost 10 years ago now. Wow. But yeah, Fred also Armisen, check out Fred Happy Armisen. Endings on Hulu if you're tired of watching The Office and Friends for the 20th time while you're quarantined.
Yeah, please stop watching that over and over again. I just watch more. Please do. My next one up is an actress I have come to really like from back in the day, and whose career has been overshadowed because of a tragic event in her life, and that was her death, and that's Natalie Wood. Natalie Wood was started off as a child actress in Golden Age of Hollywood, transitioned to like being a teen actor, and then became like a grown up actress. I think she's one of the first few, the first one I know of that was successful in transitioning from different periods in her career. I think because of her death, the drowning and the mystery that surrounds that, look that up if you don't know about it. But her, that's overshadowed the work that she put out throughout her career. She got 3 Oscar nominations throughout her career that no one talks about. One of those is a movie called Love with a Proper Stranger, which is by a director I think is underrated but didn't talk about because he's not that big. Robert Mulligan, who also directed To Kill a Mockingbird. His follow-up to Kill a Mockingbird was a movie called Love with a Proper Stranger, and it stars Natalie Wood and Steve McQueen. Steve McQueen, and one of his like more like... It's a very different movie for him, too. It's right when he does Great Escape, but it's kind of this weird rom-com drama. It's like romantic dramedy where it's 63, I believe. But Natalie Wood, Steve McQueen, Natalie Wood has a... They have a one-night stand, and she comes to Steve McQueen asking for him to help her pay for an abortion, which feels very ahead of its time in terms of, like, 63. And I think it balances the tones very well of dark drama and then the comedy of their chemistry. And you can find that on Pluto TV as well. All the movies are on Pluto TV. Don't know why. But it's quick watch. We did a screening of it for our Cine Nation Presents here in Los Angeles and got a pretty good reception. And I think she was just an underrated kind of star. I think sometimes her range was not as great as certain actors or actresses of her day, but she had this charisma that was just kind of amazing to watch. And Love with a Proper Stranger, which she was nominated for an Oscar for, is probably one of her best and one of her least talked about movies. What's your final one, Thomas?
All right, my final one comes with a movie and an episode of television to watch, both streamable on Hulu.
Okay.
And I'm going to preface it by saying I think a film that hit VOD from who I've talked to, I think a movie that hit VOD at a perfect time for everyone to see it who's quarantining is Knives Out, which is a lot of fun. Very fun movie. But I don't think, as much as I enjoyed him being in the movie, I don't think Lakeith Stanfield had enough to do in that movie. And I'm going to say, a lot of you probably know he's probably the most mainstream of the up and coming actors I'm picking here. But, I just want to point out that he is one of the best actors that we have right now at just being reacting to just the weirdest stuff going on around him.
Yeah, yeah.
You've definitely seen him in Get Out. You've hopefully seen him in Short Term 12, which we've been talking a lot about lately on the podcast. I know you guys had a long talk during the 100th episode.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a movie and an episode of Atlanta I want to recommend to you.
Okay.
I want to recommend an episode of Atlanta, which is streaming on Hulu now with all of FX's content, called Teddy Perkins. Mm-hmm. You do not have to have seen the rest of the show. It's a standalone episode.
Yeah.
All you have to know is that Lakeith Stanfield's character, his name is Darius. He's kind of like the third. He's not really the lead of the show. And just as you're watching this show, he's kind of like the sidekick. And then all of a sudden, he just took the lead in this one episode, and it changed everything about the show. I think it just it's so different and weird and incredible, and I've seen it way too many times. Even if you haven't seen the show, I highly recommend watching that one. I always try to start people who I recommend that show to on an episode past maybe like the first 3, because I don't think the very beginning of the show really shows you how weird and unique the show gets. And I think Teddy Perkins is the ultimate episode of that show. I think it's just everyone. Hiro Murai, who's their regular director, and Donald Glover and Lakeith Stanfield, and everyone is just firing on all cylinders there. Highly recommend. Please check that episode out. And then if that's not weird enough for you, if that's too weird for you, if you go, oh, Teddy Perkins is too weird for me, do not watch this next movie. But if that's not weird enough for you, please watch Sorry to Bother You, because it will blow your mind. When I try to describe this movie to people, I still can't believe that I actually saw this that it was a movie. I don't know how much else I can tell you. It's Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, Armie Hammer's in it. Yeah. It's about telemarketing and the gentrification of Oakland and the capitalism and, oh my God, you're not, I can't prepare. I'm not even like trying to prepare you for it, because I can't. But if you enjoy like utterly weird, dark comedies, it's on Hulu. Watch it, please.
It's a Oakland double feature with Blindspotting that came out the same year.
Very both incredible movies. Yeah. Very different ways to approach talking about gentrification.
And Blindspotting found HBO Go. So if you have both those. Yeah, Blindspotting, I would say, feels more realistic, but there's still parts that are also kind of fantastical in it.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry to bother you, I saw it in theaters, and that's a weird movie.
Yep.
And I know if you can't buy into the weirdness early on, you will not get into it as it goes on.
It will only get weirder. It hits a certain level of weirdness where you're like, all right, it's just like kind of like offbeat comedy, but like then it's just there's a certain point you hit and there is no turning back.
To go with that, a little bit of that weirdness, the last movie I'll recommend is from an actor that I have again grown to love in the past few years, just watching a lot of stuff as an older actor, and it's Rock Hudson. And Rock Hudson was an actor who did a lot of different movies in terms of genre. Did All That Heaven Allows and a lot of kind of Douglas Sirk movies, which were these kind of melodramas. He did kind of these screwball comedies with Doris Day, with like Pillow Talk. And he did The Giant, which is kind of this like family drama with James Dean and Elizabeth Taylor. But the movie I wanted to recommend that I think is probably one that people would like nowadays. I feel like it's, especially if you're into like these Get Out type horror films in a way. A movie called Seconds, directed by John Frankenheimer. And Seconds is where Rock Hudson is this character where, essentially in this world, came out in 1966, basically this character's lost purpose in his life, and in this world, these rich people can actually essentially take someone else's life over. So what they do is, they hire the service essentially fakes your death, and then transfers your consciousness and all that over. I think they do like maybe plastic surgery over to the person you want to be. They end up killing the person or get rid of the person that you want to become, and then you take over that person's persona and start living their life. Crazy movie, especially for 66, shot by this DP named James Wong Howe, who's one of the greatest black and white cinematographers of all time. It's just a crazy film, especially when you look at the time period of when it took place. A lot of people kind of feel that like Hollywood changed in like 67, 68 when Bonnie and Clyde movies like that came out, but Hollywood was slowly moving towards these more subversive movies, and Seconds kind of follows that. I feel like a lot of sci-fi films or horror films today have taken a lot from this movie, and you can find it streaming on Prime, Canopy, and Pluto TV. I don't think it's on Criterion, but it is a Criterion release as well. So worth checking out if you guys want to see kind of a crazy 1960s sci-fi film. There you go. Thomas, anything else?
I think that's it.
That's all we have.
Hit me up if you need any more recommendations. I got plenty.
Same.
Just, you know, everybody stay sane. Take this as an advantage to explore art and media that you've been meaning to, and you were not saying just stream everything. Go read a book, go hang out in your backyard, draw, write, do whatever. But like we gotta continue to exercise ourselves physically and creatively is what I've found so far. And I'm less far into it than everybody else. Georgia still isn't really locked down yet, but we're just doing it voluntarily because it's the smart thing to do.
Yeah.
This is a great time to get creative and to appreciate creativity, so let's do it.
Yeah, not many times will we get this chance to do things. It's a hard time for a lot of people, but if you have the ability to try new things or explore new things, it's a blessing in a weird way, because very few times do you get a few months of where there's no deadlines for something. But I hope you guys stay safe, wash your hands, social distance, Skype with people, make sure also not just like exploring things like that, but also stay in touch with people. I know right now people can get stir crazy, in the midst of this, and you kind of have to be active, not just physically and creatively like Thomas is saying, but also just with your friends still. Like I've tried reaching out to people that I haven't talked to in a while, because we had this time where it's kind of like, we kind of know everyone else isn't doing anything. So you might as well reach out to them and see like, hey, how's it going? So yeah, guys, thank you for listening. We will hopefully be back on our format come next time. We have some movies to catch up on. But make sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that good stuff. Make sure you sign up for our email list. Right now, in the midst of all this, all of our screenings have been kind of canceled or postponed. We're going to figure that out in the future, what we're going to do. I think right now in Los Angeles, a lot of things, like our gatherings over 10 or below, or anything over 10 people is a gathering that is kind of being outlawed right now. Again, thank you so much for listening, guys. Thomas, as always, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, man.
During this time. Guys, thank you so much. Hope you listen to more episodes soon. Bye.